Happy New 2009. Day 2.
So here's all my information. The main thing is my weblog, so mikechambers.com. You can find, I'll post the slides there in any of the examples that aren't already online. I'll also post on there. So here, I'll just go over really quickly the things we're going to cover in the session today. We're going to look at maybe some intermediate level stuff in AIR, some tasks or patterns that you're going to come across from time to time when doing AIR development. We're going to look at how to monitor files for when the files change, monitor volumes, so when the user puts a new drive in, a CD-ROM, something like that, be able to monitor when those are added or removed. Look at strategies for persisting data in objects, specifically ActionScript objects. I'll look at caching assets for offline use, as well as performance syncing, some data synchronization, especially for syncing stuff that, some changes that may have occurred offline, syncing that when you get back online. And also look at some notification strategies. And depending on the time, we may drop one or two of these. We'll look at some strategies for extending AIR also to do some things that the runtime doesn't necessarily support. You guys hear me okay? I can't see you at all, so if you have a question, you have to yell. So first thing is, a lot of the libraries and a lot of the code I'm going to show today, I've put them in reusable libraries. You can grab those in AS3 core lib library. If you're not familiar with this library, this is an open source ActionScript 3 library. It has a lot of useful utilities and functionality that you may use a lot. And there's a namespace in there specifically for AIR classes. And a lot of the stuff I'm talking about today, you can find here, download that code, and use. So the first thing we're going to talk about is file monitoring. And specifically, being able to detect when a file changes or when a file is created or deleted. So within Adobe AIR, within the runtime, there's no built-in way or API to monitor files. So if you want to know when, maybe you're tracing a log file or something like that, you want to know when that's changed, there's not a built-in way to do that. And then it's, when you first look at the problem, it's like, okay, well, that's not too difficult. I'll just, run a loop and a timer and look and see if, some attribute of the file changed. And if it does, then I know it's changed. But actually, it's a little more difficult than that because you have to worry about things like, okay, what if I'm watching the file and the file gets deleted? Or what if I'm watching the file, but it doesn't exist yet, and then it gets added? So there's a couple of things you have to watch out for. So I actually took a lot of this functionality, put it in a class, but we'll actually go through this, look how to use this, and we'll just jump right in here. So again, all these, the core code for all this you can grab online, and I'll post these examples on my weblog after the conference. So first one, I'm just in a Flex Builder here. Really big font. Okay. So you guys see that okay? Anyone not see that? Okay, cool. So first, let's just look at the example. So I'm just going to run. This is a simple AIR example. And basically, let's create a file. So, hello WebDU. And I'm going to save this on my desktop. We'll just call it, test.txt. I already had one. Okay. So now I just created a file on my desktop. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to watch that file. So from this little app, I'm just going to select the file. And it'll actually load it and display the contents in here. So you can see Hello WebDU. It might be a little difficult to see that. So it's watching that file now. And we'll go through this code in just a second. But we're watching that file. And now if I go in here and, good day, mate, there. Okay. So if I save that, and then you notice here, in the app, it picks up those changes, so it noticed that change, right? Really simple example. Let's look at the code, how we did that. The first thing is, pretty straightforward. I just basically, when you click that button, I open a browse dialog so you can select the file. The user can select the file. when the user selects a file, there's a couple of things going on here. So first I get a reference to that file. And then I create this class called FileMonitor. And this is the class that is included in AS3 Core Lib. And basically this class does a couple of things. And specifically it watches a file. So I'm going to listen for two events. And the first is a change event. And that's if the file has changed. So in the case where we did it, you know, I wrote some more data to it. So the file size changed. The timestamp on it changed. So it'll throw an event when anything about the file changes. And then there's another event that it will broadcast, which is a move event. And this is if the file gets moved or deleted, because essentially it's the same thing as far as, yes, if you rename the file, it'll throw a move event also. And so in this case, I'm not moving or anything, but basically that's the API. Then for the monitor, I specify the file that the user selected, right, through the browse dialog, and then I just tell it to watch. Now in the API, you can watch and unwatch and stuff like that. But basically, that's the whole API, and that's all you need to do. Anytime that file changes or is moved, then you know events will get broadcast, and you can know they've been moved. Now one thing, if we look inside this class, I mean, essentially, is what's going on is. Is I'm running a timer and I'm looking at some attributes. Let's see, I'm trying to remember what attribute. Yeah, so I'm looking at the modification date in this right now. But basically, when you start watching, I'm just have a timer and I'm looking every couple of maybe like once a second. Yeah, so once a second, I'm just checking that file. Now, one thing to keep in mind is if you have to watch a whole lot of files, maybe you have to watch 100 files or something. Well, you know, you don't necessarily want 100 timers running altogether. So one thing that I want to add to this, which I haven't done yet, but that if you're doing this, something you could do, is you could basically pass in the timer so all your file monitor instances can share the same timer. So it's not using up nearly as many resources if you had, you know, 100 timers going, because timers can be pretty CPU intensive, especially if you have a lot of them and if you're calling them at really frequent intervals. So anyways, that's just a really simple example. The class makes it really easy to watch files. And again, you can download this. This also works for directories, so if you want to watch for changes in a directory or if the directory is renamed or moved, this will work for that also. You can just point to have it point to a directory. And I'll take questions as we go along. So if anyone has any questions, just raise your hand or shout out. And if we have time at the end, I'll take questions then also. Let's see. So the next thing I want to talk about is related, and that's a volume monitoring. And essentially, that's being able to detect when a new volume is added to the system or removed. And by volume, I mean something like a USB drive, a FireWire drive, maybe a CD-ROM, maybe when you plug in your camera and it's mounted as a drive. But being able to detect that when that happens within AIR. And again, there's not built-in. This isn't built-in. Okay. This isn't built into Adobe AIR, this functionality. We're actually, for the next version of AIR, this is something we're working on, so this eventually you won't have to do this yourself. And again, it seems like it'd be something that might not be too difficult because you just, you know, watch for, put it on a timer and watch for the volumes to change. Well, the thing that gets to be a hassle is that when you, there's a file.getroots directory API, with Adobe AIR, but it's inconsistent across platforms. What it returns is inconsistent. So on Windows, it will actually return an array of all your drives, so your C drive, D drive, you know, whatever drives you have mounted. But on Mac and Linux, it returns a single volume or a single thing, which is your root drive, so just a slash. So one of the things that this the library does is it'll abstract that away because it knows how to look into, say, on Mac and Windows and actually find those volumes. So we can look at another simple example. Okay, let me close this. We'll look at volume monitor. Again, this is really simple. We'll look at it really quickly. And they have a USB drive here, so you should be able to see that. So right now I have just one volume, and if I go into Finder, you can see there's my, you know, my main drive, and that's showing up here. So this one I have to tell it to start monitoring. If I plug this in, and it'll take just a second, and there you see, it's kind of hard to see, but basically there's the other drive, so it detected it. Now if I go into Finder and I disconnect this, and it'll take again just a second. There you go, and so it removed it, right? Pretty straightforward stuff. So this is really useful if you're if you want to pull images off a camera that's mounted as when it mounts as a hard drive, or you know, USB drive. But the API is actually really very similar to the file monitor API. And essentially, when we just we create a new monitor instance, so it's called Volume Monitor. And again, this is a class included with AS3 CoreLib, so you can download that, change it, play around with it, do whatever you want. This broadcasts two events. One is add volume, and one is remove volume. And those are pretty self-explanatory. You know, add volume, when a new volume is added, it'll broadcast an event. When a volume is removed, it'll broadcast the remove volume event. And then we just start watching. And again, it has these watch and unwatch because it's using a timer to kind of pull and check for that. And there's no, if we don't need to know about it right away, we want to be able to turn that off so it doesn't use up those resources, CPU resources. By default, this is checking, let's see, I believe every 4 seconds. Where is it? Well, let's see. Oh, here we go. Yes, checking every 2 seconds. And again, if you were using this and watching a lot of files, then you could change the code so that you could actually take a single timer and that they all could share that timer just to be a little more efficient and not have a whole bunch of timers running. So again, this is pretty straightforward stuff. It's really simple now because, you know, we have the classes that you can use, and you don't have to worry about, you know, building in all this functionality and having to, you know, worry about debugging and everything like that. So the next thing I want to talk about is data objects, object persistence. And specifically, I want to talk about taking ActionScript objects and archiving those or writing those to a file in the file system, reading and writing them. This is the technique that I use pretty much in every error application I work on. Anything that has any settings, I usually have a settings class. And to save my settings, I just write that class to the file system. And then you can read the class directly back. But it's also really useful because you can actually use it as a custom file format for your application, similar to like an FLA for Flash or a Word file. You can basically archive your object structure hierarchy directly to the file system, load that back up. So it's a really easy way to save the state of your application. Yeah. Yeah, so that's a good question. So the question was, are there issues with versioning? So if you change your class, like let's say I save my objects out, and this will make a little more sense when I look at it, and then I change my class, maybe one of those properties aren't there, or I add some extra properties, you can run into some issues. But usually is what happens, it'll fail silently a lot of times, and you'll get null values where you don't expect them. So if you're using this, is what you want to do is maybe you've updated your application for the user. You're going to have to do some process where it converts between the two formats. Yeah, I'm sorry. The buzz is really distracting me. What was your question again? Yeah, and is what will happen is those will come across as null. Yeah. Okay. So let's look at an example, and this will make a little more sense too. And let's see, we want to look at here we go. So we'll just run this example really quickly. So this is just a simple example. There's no data in here right now. This is a little contact manager I wrote, so I'll put in my name, Mike Chambers, and my email is mesh@adobe.com. I want to add this contact. And now what I'm going to do, I'm going to close the app, and I'm going to relaunch it. And you notice the contact's there, so it's saved that state. If we look at what's actually going on here, save contacts. Okay, so you see up here at the top, I have this array collection called contacts, and this is basically an array collection of contact classes. And if we look at the contact class, which is right here, and this is just a class with some name value pairs, right? You know, first name, last name, email address, right? So very simple. I just store these contacts in the array collection, and that's bound to my data grid, and you know, so I can display those. Now, you notice at the top of this, we have this remote class metadata, and what this does, this basically tells the compiler what class this is associated with, and when this is important is because there's an API. There's actually two APIs, and one is called, both on the file object, or actually the file stream, and the read object and write object. And what this allows you to do, it basically allows you to take an object, in this case an array collection, write it out to the file system. And it actually uses AMF to encode that. And then it also allows you to read that in. What that metadata does is it tells the player, reading these objects back in, it tells the player what class that's associated with. And then it'll make sure it's, you know, cast, it has all the right functions, APIs on that. Does this make sense? I kind of jumped forward there. So basically what happens is I have this array collection, it's bound to the data grid. When I clicked the add contacts, down here. So down here at the bottom here, I'll move this up. So let me launch the app so you can see it. So we have the button here. Okay. Come on, compile. We have the button that is, here we go. So the add contact button, that's clicked. That goes to here. And is what I do is basically I create a new contact class, and I just populate it from the data that the user pushed in. And then I say I add it to my array collection, right? So now I have this array collection just with all the contacts. But then I call this function called save contacts. And what that does is it takes that array collection and I actually write it out to the file system and using the write object API. So basically I'm taking an array collection, and that array collection contains other ActionScript objects, and I write that out to the file system. So then when the application starts up, you can see, then I call this load contacts API, and basically it kind of does the reverse. So it looks to where I wrote that file, and it loads in that array collection with those contacts. Now the key thing is that, again, this metadata on the contacts class, so the player knows that this is an instance of the contacts class. Otherwise, it'll just come back as an object, and none of the functions will be there. You'll still have the properties, but none of the functions. Yeah. Yeah, so the format it's serializing in. The format it's using is AMF. This is the same format if you're using AMF to send data to the server back and forth. You could get the bytes from this, do whatever you want with it. You could stream it over a socket. You pretty much do whatever you want with it. As far as the actual AMF format, we've released the specs for this. There's a lot of libraries for Java, PHP, stuff like that that know how to decrypt that and use it too. Yeah. Yes. So in order for the player to know about the class that it's converting, this com.mikechambers.contact, it has to be compiled into the Swift somewhere. So if you're not instantiating it directly somewhere, like in my case, I say new contact in their code so it gets called in, you have to make sure that you have a reference to it in there or it won't get included into your Swift. And then the player doesn't know what that is. Yeah, that's a good point. Yes. So if you had the question was if you had, say, an address object and there was a property called address on the contact, would that also get serialized? As long as you put the metadata, the player's smart enough to know. It looks at the properties, okay, what is this? It looks at the metadata, and it'll include, essentially what it's doing is when it writes it out, it puts a little data saying, hey, this is a contact class or whatever. But yeah, it'll go through. And that's actually what's happening here. In this case, I'm just saving the array collection. And the array collection has this metadata in it. And then the player is smart enough to know, oh, it has a reference to a contact. And then it goes and finds this. Yeah. So the key is this metadata. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, if the data's not stored, then it's not there, right? Is what the player is actually doing, and you can see this if you don't put the metadata. Basically, it looks at all. It goes and serializes. It serializes all the properties, okay? And then it puts in this metadata and says what it is. When you pull it back, if you don't put the metadata, you just get an object with the properties. When you put the metadata, you get the object with the properties, but then it also says, okay, this is a contact, and basically attaches all the APIs and functions, stuff like that, including getters and setters, because those are functions. So that's what's going on. If you just have a getter that doesn't store the value in a property, or it's just not stored anywhere, then the player doesn't have any way to get that data if it's not there, right? But if you have it like here, you can see I'm putting in private variables, and in this case, then those will get serialized and then deserialized. If you don't, again, if you didn't do this, is what you'd get is an object with this like underscore first name, underscore last name, underscore email, just a type object. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. So the question is, when it's deserializing, is it calling the getters and setters? And I'll be honest, I don't know. I'm pretty sure it doesn't, though. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah, and if that's something you need to, I would say make sure you test it, because the implementation of what's doing the serializing, deserializing may be a little different in AIR for the file object than what it's doing for setting over the net connection, stuff like that. Because, so the question is, why do you need to define it? Yes, it's always going to be the, well, it technically wouldn't have to be. It wouldn't make sense, though, for you to define some metadata for some other class. But the reason is because when this is writing it out, if you don't put that metadata, then the player, it just serializes the object, essentially, in the data values, the values. And this tells it, puts a little thing in there saying, this is the type of class it is. And I don't know, they probably do that for, it optimizes it, because then they don't have to like serialize all the information about that class, all the functions and stuff. Because basically, once this is serialized, it doesn't know anything about the class. All that data about the class is in the Swift at the runtime. And then it basically puts those together when it's deserialized. So again, I'm guessing the reason they did it that way is so they don't have to completely serialize all the information about, say, a contact class, right? So that would be all the getters and setters in this case. It only has to serialize the properties. Yeah, I don't know. This is the way it is, why they did it like that. But I'm guessing they did that just so it's for optimization purposes. Yeah. I'm sorry, what? Could someone close that door back there? Sorry. No. No, because, sorry. So if you reference yourself, yeah, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, it's far enough to know. I haven't actually tried that because I usually don't have classes that reference. But yeah. Okay, anyone else? We talked about this a little earlier. If this class refers to, let's say we had an address class, then that class will also be serialized. Now, that you have to make sure the address class sets the metadata, or otherwise you just get back an object and you may run into some issues. Yeah. I don't know. Okay. Anyone else? Okay. So this technique, though, like of persisting ActionScript objects, is really, really useful. It's pretty simple to do, but it's really useful because, and again, like I use it all the time for any app that has any settings, because I usually have a settings class that has, you know, whatever the settings are. And then whenever that changes, I just write that to the file system, right? And then when I load up my app, I just load that back up. So, but also for, you know, persisting data, saving out file formats. And actually, I have another example here. Let's look at data persistence example 2. And this is basically going to use the same technique, but then allow me to basically, you know, create a file I can distribute, save my data in. And so we'll put in Mike Chambers. So I'll add the contact, and I'm going to save this, and I'll put it on my desktop. I'll just call it contacts.db. Right? So now if I close this, I can't remember if I persist it. Yeah, okay. So now if I close it, I can go and load that file, or I could send it, you know, if you wanted to use this very full-featured contact manager. I'm going to be selling it for $10. So, but you could send this file, so now I'm going to load the file, and there's my data. And actually, if we look at the file, we can actually look at it. So here's what it looks like. It's not showing some of the non-printable characters, but you can kind of glance at it, see what's going on there. But basically, it's serializing the data. In this case, it's an array collection. You can see from there, and you can see the raw data in there. Yeah, and actually, this technique, like, we'll use this for some other stuff a little further in. How much time? Okay, we're doing okay. So the next thing I want to talk about is caching assets. And this is basically taking assets that are maybe remote assets or you're loading in, caching them, so either for performance reasons, just so the next time you need them, you don't have to go back to the network to do them, or if you want your application to have access to these when they're offline. This is particularly useful for images that aren't going to change, as well as data that is not that, you know, the data set's not going to really change that much. You know, it's not like an RSS feed maybe that's going to or Twitter feed actually that's going to change every couple minutes, but maybe a blog feed you want to cache it like and only check it once a day or something. And again, there's a class in the AS3 core lib that handles this, and we'll look at this. And the first thing, so I have an example. Let's see if I still have a network connection. Okay. Here we go. So I have a simple example here. I'm just going to run this. And basically, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put in a URL to an image. And it's going to load that image and display it. So if I go to Flickr, let me do this. So here's an image that I haven't loaded yet from Flickr. Okay, so there's an image with some beer from the Netherlands. So let's take this image and put it in our app. There we go. Okay, I'm going to load the image. It's going to take a second because I'm on the connection's a little slow. There we go. So it loaded that image, okay? So now I'm going to close the app. Run it again, and now I'm going to again load the image, and this time you notice it loaded immediately. Essentially is what I'm doing there is I, you know, the first time I go to load it, I go out to the to Flickr, grab the image, display it, and then cache those bytes to the file system. The next time I load it, I check to see if I've cached those bytes. If I have, then I use those. Otherwise, I go out to the network. Right, so pretty simple technique, actually really useful, especially again for things like image or data sets that aren't going to change that often. So let's look at how we actually do that. And we'll look at, again, I wrote a class called Resource Cache that basically does all this for you, but we'll actually look inside of that class to see what it's doing. But you can see here when I say, you know, when I click that image or click that button to load the image, I see if I've created the cache yet, the resource cache object, and then I listen for this event called item ready. Now, this event's really important because basically it tells me when the bytes for whatever I'm trying to get are available. I don't know if those came from the network or from the local file system. Like this, the code at this level doesn't know. It just knows that, hey, they're ready. And then I say, okay, well, retrieve this URL, okay? And basically what happened on item ready gets called, and then it gives me a reference. I can pass it to the, and display it in the image thing. So let's actually look at the class though and see what it's doing. There's a couple things I want to point out. It's actually pretty simple. There's a lot of stuff in here, but the main thing that happens is you send in this URL, and then I look in a file system, and let's see. I have this function called getItemFile, and basically, hold on. So we call retrieve, right? And then is what I do is I take that URL you passed in, and I hash that, and I use a MD5 hash in this case. And the reason I hash it is because if you use MD5, you're going to get characters that will work. You don't have to worry about having invalid characters for file names. So you won't have some weird Unicode character or something like that. So I hash it, and that way I can save that the file or the bytes as that hash name. And we'll look at this. It'll make a little more sense in just a second. But basically then I hash the URL, and then I look in the on the file system in my storage directory to see if I have a file called by that hash. So essentially, the URL is the key. If there's a file with that key or that hash, then I just load that because I know it's the same thing. If it's not there, then I just go out to the network, load it. Then once it's loaded, I'll actually write it to the file. So let's see, on data load, look at this. Right, so you can see here I've gone out to the network, and then basically, I'm writing that file or those bytes out to the file system, and then I'm naming the file the hash or the key from the URL. So essentially this URL for this resource, and this could be a local URL also. It doesn't have to be a remote URL. But this URL becomes the key for that resource. So it's pretty straightforward. And see here, so I'm using MD5 to hash the key. You could use SHA or stuff like this, but it's not really encrypting it. I'm just trying to hash it so I know I have a name that's going to be unique, and that's not going to cause me problems for writing out the file system. If you're using older version of Windows, you might run into issues. I don't even know if we support. What version only supported 32 characters? Anyone remember? It's an old version. I don't think Air supports it, so you don't have to worry about that. But if we look at the resource cache example, here are the actual files. And this is the one we just loaded. This is actually a JPEG, but you can see that's that hash right there, that weird 23119, that's actually an MD5 hash of the URL for that file, right? So that's the key. And then we can actually, I can open this with a preview. And you can actually see the file. So if we open that, and so there's the file. So it's basically, the resource class doesn't know what the bytes are, what it's loading. It doesn't know it's an image, it's a text file, or, you know, it could be an MB3 file, anything. But it's basically, it's taking those bytes, writing them to the file system, and next time, you know, the user asks for that resource, then instead of loading it from the network, it just loads them locally. Now, you can start doing, and, you know, this class will not, it doesn't put timestamps on them or stuff like that. But if you wanted to do something like, okay, I only want, you know, I don't want anything to be cached that's more than a day old. So then is what you could do. You could modify this pretty easily to look at the timestamp for that file. And if it's more than a day old, then you always go to the network, right? So that way you can start having some cache policies depending on the type of data you're loading. So maybe images, you never go back. You only get those once. Maybe the RSS feed, you don't want to cache it more than, you know, 30 minutes or something. So that's something that would be pretty simple to add to this. Anyone have any questions about this? Okay. I explained it so clearly that it's okay. Yeah. I'm sorry? Do I not strip the query string? No. Because I don't know what, like, that query string may determine what's actually coming back. And by hashing it, then I don't have to worry about weird characters again mucking up my file name. Yeah, so whatever URL is passed in there. So that's actually a good point, too, because if you pass in a query, you know, a URL that has two different query strings that may result in the same resource, it's going to get cached twice. Because that query string is hashed to create the key, or that URL is hashed to create the key. Okay. So, next thing I want to talk about is syncing offline data. I'm going to talk about this at a little higher level. I won't go into the code on this, but it's going to use some of the techniques we've already talked about. But basically, this is looking at, if let's say you have an application. The user is entering some data or taking an image or something like that, and they're offline or they have a poor connection. And you want to make sure that data always gets to the server. This will talk about how you can do that. So even if you're online, when you go back online, how to get that data back to the server, to sync that back up. And again, this is really useful for offline applications or for applications that you may have to use in a state where you have a really poor internet connection. So we'll show a simple example. Again, let's see. Air snapshot. This is actually an application that originally wrote for, we did this bus tour a couple years ago through North America. And we had this application on the bus that once a minute it would take a picture of what was happening on the bus and then upload that to Flickr. Well, you can imagine, you know, going on a bus through the U.S. that sometimes you're not going to have data connectivity, but we wanted to make sure you wouldn't ever lose those images. So when it come back online, then it'd start sending them. This will take a picture and upload it to Flickr. That's what this app does. But in this case, I'm going to disconnect my internet connection. Okay, and you can see it actually detects it. So there are APIs included within Adobe Air and included in the Air SDK that allow you to detect network changes, status changes. So I'm using that to detect here that I just went offline. So I'm going to take a picture. Oh, I didn't smile, but anyways, I took a picture. And you can see, okay, it's taking image. I know it's kind of hard to read, and it's saying, oh, I'm offline, so I'm not going to send the file. Okay? And now if I go back online, and this, again, will take just a second. If you watch over here, we're going to come online. It'll take a second for the app. It's going to detect that it's online. What's actually going on in the background, then it's saying, oh, do I have any files, any images I need to upload? There you go. So you see it's online now. And it will, there it goes. Right? And so it uploaded the image, and then it's like, oh, there's no more files to upload. So if we go to Flickr now, there's a picture of me and my. Do you guys have Burger King here? Okay. Do they wear shirts like this? My wife calls this my Burger King shirt. Anyways. You have a picture of me. Let's see if it's on here yet. In my Burger King shirt. Yeah, so there it is, right? So when it went back on, it sent to the server. Now, the way I'm saving that data is I'm actually some of the stuff we were talking about earlier, serializing objects, stuff like that. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I can't answer if we're ever going to get background threads or threading because I don't know, right? Ever is a long time. Right now, if you do something that's very CPU intensive, it's going, you know, the action script is single threaded, so it'll hang it. Now, on this specifically, I'm doing some work with a developer who actually posted on my web. I just Twittered it actually right before the session. We're working on improving the performance for the JPEG compression and PNG. But then if, let's say you're doing some really intensive stuff, maybe huge images or something, and you know it maybe takes 5-10 seconds to do this, there are ways you can offload this to other processes to do that so it doesn't hang your UI, and then when it's ready, you can get back. We'll talk about that. I'll make sure we cover that. But we'll talk about that, ways you can do that. So there's my picture, right? I took it offline. So I'm not going to show the code for this one. All this code is, again, online, but I do want to go through the steps of what's actually happening. Again, this is online too if it's difficult to read, but basically, you know, I take a picture, and I have this class that kind of manages this queue. And basically I say, okay, take a picture, add it to the queue. The picture, it'll go, as soon as I do that, first I add it to an array, and this is an array of images that are waiting to be uploaded, because I upload one at a time, and when it comes back, it's done, then I upload the next one. So I add it to that array, and I write that array to the file system, you know, using the technique we used earlier. That way, if my application crashed right away, or maybe the user just closed it, I don't lose any data. And next time the app starts up, I still have that data because it's been persisted to the file system and in memory. So I add it. I go to, can't see my mouse, but this next step, send a next image. And I say, okay, well, am I sending an image right now? Am I in the process of uploading something? Right? And if it's no, then let's say it's yes because that'll be easier. If it's yes, I am sending something. then I say, okay, that's fine. I'm not going to do anything, right? So I'm done. If I'm not sending anything, then I check to see if I'm online. If I'm not online, then again, I don't do anything. If I am online, then I'm like, okay, well, let's send this to the server. When I hear back from the server that it was successful, right, then I remove it from the array and remove it from the file system, okay, because I'm done. It's been uploaded. It's great. If I get an error back from the server, is what I do in this case is I stop sending. You could try to send it again. You could try to send it maybe 3 times. If it fails, you stop. But is what we found on the tour was if we get an error back from the server, it means the connection's down, but the computer, not necessarily the app, but the computer doesn't realize it's down yet. And so we just pause it, and then eventually there'll be a network status change. It'll start the whole process again. Otherwise, you get in this thing where it keeps just trying to send this one file over and over when it's actually not connected. There's also, you see up here, online and offline. So if you get an online event, then it kind of starts this whole process. So if you've been offline, then you're online, that says, okay, we'll send the next image. It kind of starts this process. The key here is that, one, you have basically a stack of image you're sending one at a time. And as one is sent successfully, you remove it and then send the next one. And then these are stored in memory and at the file system. And in memory, just for performance, it's just easier to a little quicker to access them from memory. But we write them to the file system. We keep that memory and the file system in sync just in case the app crashes so you don't lose any data. Okay? Does this make sense? Again, the code for this is online. You can check out the code for this example, download it, play with it. But this is essentially what's going on. Okay? Now, before someone asks, like, one thing I'm not covering here is, you know, what if there are multiple clients and they're both changing the same data, right, in the server, or maybe the data's changed on the server. In this case, it doesn't matter. I'm just uploading images, but maybe I'm, you know, doing a tax record or something like that. So in that case, it gets more complex because you still go through this process, but for the send successful, now it branches more, right? Because it could be, okay, data's fine, it's new data, nothing to change, you're good. Or you could get a message back saying, well, I got your data, but the data here had changed, right? And then you have to, then it gets kind of more complicated depending on what you need to do. Because you have a conflict between your two people have made a change to the data. And there's different ways you can approach that, but you could, you know, the server could always be right, the client could always be right. You could put up a UI for the user to choose which one. You could do a diff of the changes, have the user pick which data should go through. I'm not going to go into that, because that's, you know, how you deal with that is going to depend on your application. But this sort of flow of going to the server, back and forth, stuff like that, that's still going to apply. It's just you're going to branch off a little more if there's a conflict. Okay? Anyone have any questions about that? Okay, I got about 10 more minutes. So I'm going to just talk to this just really quickly. I'm not going to show any demos because I want to get into something else. But desktop notification strategy. So AIR has some built-in APIs for sending notifications or alerts to the users. The APIs it has built in, though, are it just leverages the operating system functionality. So on Mac, you can bounce the dock icon for the application. On Windows, you can manipulate system tray icons and taskbar entries. You can flash them, stuff like that. There is one thing a lot of AIR applications do, because all of these are just kind of something happened, but you can't really put a message in them or, you know, say this is happening text. So what a lot of AIR application developers do is they create their own custom notifications. Then they'll put up a window, you know, raise it up and say, hey, you have a new Twitter, or, you know, Fred just sent you a message or whatever. And they can do that. That works cross platform. On Mac, there's an open source library called Growl. And it's basically a notification framework for Mac. It's pretty popular. A lot of applications use it. And they're working on support, working on adding support for AIR applications, so AIR applications can talk to Growl. They're actually working on a Windows version also. Now, there's an ActionScript library for this. I wrote an ActionScript library for it, and it works great, except they haven't put it in a public build yet. So if you want to play around with this, you can grab a development build of Growl and start playing around with it. And eventually, this will be in the Growl releases. But yeah, it's been in there for about 6 months now. So they move at their own pace. But anyways, I just wanted to speak to that really quickly, because the thing I want to talk about is extending Adobe AIR. And this is going to what we talked about earlier about offloading processing. So first of all, there's no formal API or supported way to add functionality to AIR, right? You can't have your app load a DLL or some other library. This is something that comes up a lot. Developers really want to do it. For the first version of AIR, we decided not to. One, because we had a lot of other stuff we had to do. But also, because this has the potential of fragmenting the cross-platform nature of the applications, it wasn't one of our higher priorities. Moving forward is something we're looking at, and for 2.0 we'll be doing solving a lot of the problems that people want to extend it for, but I'm not going to go into that. So again, you can't load in native code to an AIR application. But what you can do is what I call this command proxy pattern. And if you're at the Birds of the Feather, the Flex Birds of the Feather last night, we talked about this a bit. Essentially, this is you have an application that you install, a native application, that you install with your AIR application. It basically acts as a proxy between the AIR application and the operating system. Okay? Now, if you want to do this, you really have to write your own custom installer, because you have to put this native app there. You have to make sure the shortcuts point to that and handle that correctly. And if you license, you can apply for a license to redistribute the AIR runtime. And it's free, and we just want to know who's doing it. When you do that, you get another SDK, and it includes information about how to do a silent install with AIR. So you could create a custom package that will install your application, install this proxy application, and then if the user doesn't have AIR, it can silently install AIR also. Okay? So let's look at a quick example. Again, I just call this command proxy. I have a simple example that's written in C#, and I run it on... runs on Mac and Windows. I use Mono on Mac, although it's a little buggy because it doesn't have all the same features. But you can use any desktop language, right? You can do it in Python, you can do it in C++, Objective-C. The key is just where you want to target your application to run. So we'll look at a quick example. So normally, and we'll look at this a little more. Let's see. Let me go to command proxy. Let me just start this. Okay. Oh wait. Okay. Here we go. So normally the way this would work is the user would launch the app and they're actually launching this proxy app. The proxy app then launches the AIR app and tells the AIR app how to communicate with it. That's normally how the workflow. So the user, it's seamless to the user. In this case, I'm going in, I'm starting the proxy manually, and that way I can launch the app from Flex Builder. So let's pull up Flex Builder. And I have a simple app here and we'll look at the code for this. Second, but let's run this. And it's just an app, and it has a button that says take screenshot. Okay? So what this is going to do, it's going to take a screenshot of my entire desktop, something that's not supported in AIR, and then it's going to open that in Photoshop to edit it, right? Again, something that isn't natively supported in AIR. Okay? So I just press the button. Now it's going to take a minute to launch Photoshop. Right, so now it's launching Photoshop, and it'll be launching it for just a minute. So I need some Jeopardy music on here or something. Yeah, so all this code is online. This one has its own Google code project. If you just search for command proxy, you'll find it. I don't know who asked that, so I'm just, okay, yeah. All this code's online. Now this code is proof of concept code just to demonstrate it, but it's, yeah. So there, now it's launched Photoshop, and it's opened the file to edit in Photoshop, right? The way I did this is that I wrote this little proxy, and it it knows how to take a screenshot, right, using native code, and knows how to launch an application. In this case, how to launch. Well, it launches the application with arguments. So I tell it to launch Photoshop with the argument passing the screenshot. So the code isn't as important. We'll just look at it really quickly. I've encapsulated the communication with an ActionScript class, but you see I have this exec command. And this is, you know, there's a, on Mac, you can call a command called screen capture. It'll take a screenshot. That's how I do it. And I tell it to save it to this place. And then I listen for this command response. Basically, once I send it the proxy, when it's done with it, I get an event. And then I tell the proxy to execute this command. Again, this is all proof of concept. You can download this code. And because you're going to, this type of development is very specific to what you're doing. Okay? But this will give you an idea of how you can structure it. You can see down here is I'm opening up Photoshop, right? But the thing I want to, the important thing in here is the flow. So the life cycle of this. So basically, the user launches the application. What they're actually launching is this native code, this native command proxy. They're not launching the AIR application. That command proxy then launches the AIR application. And when it does so, it tells the AIR application, passing through the command line to launch it, it tells it how to communicate back with it. So in the case of this example, it would pass an ID and a port, because it's connecting back via a socket server, or via a socket. So it basically says, okay, launch an AIR app, port 10,000. And then you can listen for command line events as an invoke event in AIR, and you get the data from the command line. And then it says, okay, well now I connect back to the command proxy on this port. Okay, so that's how they communicate. Now, right now, I just pass a port. I don't pass an ID. I don't encrypt the data or anything because it's a proof of concept. But in general, you want to pass some unique key there back that only this app would know about, right? Because you're just passing it there. That way, and then if you know a command comes into the proxy and it doesn't have that key or it has an invalid key, then you just ignore it. And that way, something else can't hijack the proxy. It's not really an issue because if there's something on your desktop that can hijack the proxy, well, there's really no reason to hijack the proxy then. It's on your desktop. You can do whatever it wants. But this is a way to tighten it up a little. So now you have the command proxy running, no UI, and you have your AIR application running. The user is just, it's just one application running. That's all they really see. So now they can communicate back and forth. And in this case, I say, OK, we'll run this command, screen capture. It goes, tells the command proxy. And in this case, I've coded what it can do, right? I said, I put in functionality to run a command or run a command line command in this case. So it runs it. It goes to the operating system and runs that command, gets the feedback or gets the data back from the operating system, and then it passes it onto their application, right? So imagine, so in this case, actually this example I just showed you would only work on Mac. And that's because in Mono, there's bugs with taking screenshots on Mac. It crashes for some reason. So normally you wouldn't want to do it this way. I kind of hacked it. But you would build the functionality in you need. The native functionality you need gets built into your command proxy. You just build in the functionality you need. So in that case, I'd build in the functionality for taking a screenshot and for, say, launching an application. Okay. So this actually is used a decent amount. There's a Java framework called Merapi that's basically what it exists for. So they're doing this through Java, via Java. They have a lot of functionality built in, like screenshots, notifications, things like that. But a lot of developers also just write, it's fairly simple to write, and they just write their own little command proxies to do exactly what they need to do. But the key is that you have to remember, you have to, if you do this, you can't use the regular air install mechanism, because air is not going to set up the shortcuts for the command proxy and stuff like that. So you have to write a custom installer. You have to have the skill set to do that and to make sure that the app that's launched is the command proxy and not the air application directly. Okay? Yeah, so it's what you can do, and this is in this code, but you can essentially, there's a couple things you can do. You could, the air app could say, I'm closing, first of all. The command proxy could just see when that connection stops, right? And the socket connection ends, it could close itself, or it could actually, it knows what process the air app is running in. It could also watch that. Yeah. But yeah, the key is though, but that's the important point, is that closes. That this doesn't just run persistently. This is tied to that instance of the air application. Okay? So, I have like an AS3 reference for iPhone. You can download it. It's pretty useful. The slide's in there. Just search for AS3 iPhone on the iTunes store. And check out my weblog, mikechambers.com. A lot of this stuff's on there. I'll do another post that kind of brings it all together. All the code I showed today is available. Most of it's in AS3 core lib, which you can find by searching on Google. The other command proxy, if you just search for air and command proxy, you'll find that code. That has its own Google code project. My Twitter account, and my email is mesh@adobe.com. Feel free to send me an email if you have any questions. Just remind me that you saw me at WebDU, just so I'll know. I'll make sure to get back to you. So I'll be around the rest of the afternoon if you have any questions. So thanks a lot.